Even though you are well known, I'm sure that some members will be happy to hear about you a bit more, to hear about your biography a bit more. Thank you. So Jen Brenn is Emeritus Professor at the University of Rouen-Normandie, author of two books on popular song during the First World War. He's published widely on the musical industry after 1880 and its processes and repertoires. His most recent article, entitled Structures, Song Traditions, Fears and Fantasies, British and French Love Songs in the First World War, was published in 2026, so very recently, in the Popular Music History. And it compares and contrasts the very different love song repertoires in the two countries. And now it's up to you, John. Thank you very much for joining us online. You're going to talk about British musical song and politics between 1890 and 1914. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much to Eleanor and the organising committee for inviting me to speak this morning. And I would probably be wanting to add a question mark to the end of the session title, A Means to Gender and Class Empowerment, because it's not really clear that empowerment through song, or certainly class empowerment through song, was on the music hall programme in the period I am speaking of. Though as an aid to survival and as validation of working class experience, the music hall was very useful indeed to the people who attended. In the past, I have looked in detail at popular song in the First World War, but also at aspects of song from earlier period, as you can see by the list of works on this slide. Do stop me if anything goes wrong with the slides. Popular song does not, of course, represent some pure expression of the soul of the people. But neither does it correspond to Adorno's dystopian fantasy of empty commercial product generated by a culture industry which can decide what the people will want to buy. The song repertoire is rather a result of numerous pressures, of numerous forces with powers and with limits. In the case of the music hall around 1900, we have, first of all, the songwriters. They are writing quickly because there is no royalty system, and they're mostly paid a one-off fee for any song, even if it goes on to sell a million copies in sheet music, meaning that they have to keep churning them out. We also have the force of the music hall managers, eager to enforce rules of respectability on the repertoire, partly so as not to lose their license through a decision of some moral improvement board of magistrates. And then we have the singers, mostly making a living and not a fortune, who have found that a little talent, carefully nurtured and presented, can lift their family out of dire poverty, but who are very conscious of the precarity of their popularity. They do not generally think of themselves as voices of the people, or indeed as artists. They think of themselves as skilled professional entertainers. In any case, they might easily go on stage literally after the acrobats and before the elephants. So the pressure to choose a repertoire which hits the audience hard and fast was practically irresistible. The audiences have powers too. They could fairly quickly damage a singer's career badly simply by not singing along with the choruses. Here are some examples of the small band of historians of the musical, although I don't have time to tell you about the contributions of each one. To look at popular song in any period, we need to know who was loving it, how it was produced, who was paying for it, who was making money from it, who was writing it and why, and what limitations were placed on it by industrial, legal, social and ideological constraints. That's a lot of things to look at, and we will not be surprised to find that within broadly explained mainstream tendencies, many exceptions, small countercurrents and surprises. So, who was listening around 1900? What characterises British society compared with most European societies is extreme urbanisation. It has already been 50 years since the rural population of England was outnumbered by the urban population. And expanding public transport is creating suburbs out of previously country's towns. The 1901 census shows the working class central to this urban population, and it will be crucial to the ecology of popular song. Of a working population of 17 million, there are over 1.5 million domestic servants, over 1 million coal miners, over 1 million agricultural workers, over 500,000 textile workers. There were over 500,000 shop assistants, as shops became already even less a purely family affair. And the popular song of this period, 1890 to 1914, was musical. It was not folk song. Impressive work was being done by folk song collectors such as Cecil Sharp and Lucy Broadwood. They were combing the countryside looking for songs from a tradition they felt was dying. Sharp's work was distinguished by its analytical precision, but also he believed that folk music was a living expression of community identity deeply tied to local customs and social life. His book, English Folk Songs, Some Conclusions, in 1907, claimed that folk music embodied a collective wisdom and artistic heritage that modern society risked losing. Lucy Broadwood believed that folk songs grew naturally out of the people. To her, music hall songs, in contrast, were manufactured commodities sold for profit. She found them cheap, vulgar, and devoid of the spiritual or historical depth that she found in rural ballads. There was an undeniable element of Edwardian class bias in her view. She viewed the urban working class, who loved music hall, as having lost its way culturally. So attempts were made to popularise folk song among urban workers, but they had little success. Factory workers, shop assistants, office clerks, domestic servants did not really want to sing about their boyfriend being press ganged into the navy or being hanged for stealing the king's deer. Songs where the heroine dies of a broken heart the day before her true love comes back to the sea attracted little. Mass fears and fantasies in 1900 did not contain village fairs, difficult harvests, witches, or duels with the lord of the manor. Although working class people filled the municipal concert halls for the very cheap subsidised classical music concerts, and although they were very active indeed in the 10,000 choral societies and the 10,000 brass bands which existed in the UK by 1900, many times more popular still were the music hall songs which explored some of their own emotional landscape. These songs were heard in a fabulously upbeat atmosphere between the ventriloquist act and the trick cyclists, and the songs invited us to sing along with friends and neighbours, feeling at home, feeling accepted. Around 1 million tickets every week were sold in London alone. The front page of local newspapers around the country advertised the week's programme at the local hall. The gramophone was rising very slowly, but was infinitely less important than the live music hall. Even in 1916, for the price of a basic gramophone, you could buy 200 cheap tickets to go to the music hall. Now, by 1900, almost two-thirds of music halls no longer allowed eating and drinking at your seats, and the music halls resembled theatres, seating from 1,000 to 5,000 people. The acts, the turns, were tremendously varied, but one-third of them were singers. They travelled from town to town. They arrived in town on Sunday, taught their tunes to the house orchestra on Monday morning, ready for first house Monday evening. And the music hall was big money. Theatre chains dominated more every year. Chains which were quoted on the stock exchange and whose representatives loudly defended the respectability of the industry, even managing to get the king along for a variety concert by royal command, in 1912. The music hall has come into its kingdom, commented Walt Pink, the organiser, afterwards. Here you have a couple of examples of the major musicals. There were many hundreds. We estimate up to 1 million spectators a day in 1900. On the right you have Bradford, on the left you have London. The working class audience was essential. The music hall managers, this is the 1890s, the music hall managers were keen to attract middle-class families to the more expensive seats, reached by separate entrances, but the working-class audience from 10 years and up, young people often left school at 12, was central to the atmosphere and to the aesthetic. You can see here there's groups of young women going out together, groups of young men going out together, and more bourgeois hats down in the stalls. The music publishers were central actors too. In 1900, just one of the main companies, Francis Day and Hunter, released 40 to 50 songs every month. Print runs were rarely under 25,000, and a hit song could sell hundreds of thousands of copies at sixpence apiece. The presence of at least 3 million pianos in Britain at this time, one for every 20 people, babies included, made this business possible. Obviously, then, the problem with summarising the politics of musical songs is that if we just look at the period in the title of my talk, we're talking of 24 years, and no doubt tens of thousands of songs. Much prudence is required. So the fact that Derek Scott, fabulous historian, could dig up a dozen music hall songs in praise of Disraeli in the year of his death must not be overinterpreted. There are hundreds of songs around. In particular, sales figures are not available. Similarly, as we shall see a little later, a few dozen patriotic songs about the Boer War do not define the politics of the music hall. In particular, since a few of the most popular were mocking or sentimental rather than nationalistic. Some songs mocked the obsession with the Boer War. Others simply spoke of the joy of one's son coming safely home. So let's look at ideas in musical songs. Ideas in musical songs had to be relatively uncontroversial, as the aim was to get the whole audience to sing along to the chorus. With 3,000, 4,000 people in the audience and no microphone, sing-along was not a luxury, but an essential part of the technology. For this reason, songs with overtly political messages were very rare. It was extremely rare, for example, to hear songs either in favour of women's suffrage or against women's suffrage. But a large number of tunes, well, dozens of tunes, mocked the extremist anti-hysterical suffragettes, because the singers felt that they could get consensus in the hall around the fact that some of them are going too far. But after 1904, the general public was generally not opposed to women's suffrage. Later, during the First World War, one did not hear pacifist songs, and after the first few months, one no longer heard enthusiastic pro-war songs. Instead, one finds dreams of the war's ends, resigned songs, or those that mocked the military hierarchy or bureaucracy. The situation of the music hall was very different from a few decades later, when gramophone records ruled the industry. If one writes in 1960 or 2010 a radical political song and 10% of the population love it, that's plenty, it's great success. But in the live music hall, the ecology was quite different. Almost everybody had to sing along, or that was a problem. Because there were thousands of songs, it is difficult to generalise, and important historians often mention the music hall in passing without looking at the thousands of songs. There is, of course, almost no information about the songs on the internet, so ChatGPT is not going to help us here, and we do not have sales figures. We do have some sources. Michael Kilgariff, a music hall insider, spent a long time comparing a list of the most influential music halls of each year, and here you can see the hits from 1900 and from 1908. The absolute domination of comic themes is clear, and we'll come back to the themes in a moment, but certainly one key use of the music hall was validating working class experience. The music hall stars had working class names, sometimes stage names: Fred, Harry, Gertie, Dan, Ada, Gus, Albert, Ernie, Florrie, Bessie. They spoke and sang in neighbourly tones as if they knew the audience. They generally had working-class accents and spoke of ordinary people's lives, though generally in a comic vision. What did they sing about? Mothers-in-laws and seaside holidays, shy fiancés, and impossible friends, ridiculous toffs, henpecked husbands, foolish fathers, adored mothers, and exasperating and violent wives, absurd misunderstandings, saucy hints, nostalgic fantasies, and outrageous little anecdotes. Music Hall, around 1900, thrived on the comic business of ordinary life, turning domestic irritation, courtship, class awkwardness, and sexual innuendo into songs. These are people's real fears and fantasies, although dealt with in hyperbolic comic form. Your mother-in-law lived across the street. Your shy fiancé, who doesn't dare to ask you to marry him, was a real nightmare. A young woman had to live with her parents until she was married. Occasionally, songs spoke of tragedy, but as one commentator remarked, no one suffered alone in the music hall. This is an infinitely less democratic age. More than half the population cannot vote in national elections. No women can vote. Only 60% of men can vote. When the First World War comes along, the Times will be printing the names of officers killed, but only those of officers. That's the atmosphere. Validating working class lives was a huge deal. I only have time for a couple of examples. This one, which celebrated working class friendship, solidarity, physicality, and pub culture. Watcha me old brown son, how are you? Watcha me old brown son, how are you? If you got the money and the time to spare, come and have a tiddly at Vienne while there. You look fine, put your hand in mine, never mind if it weighs a ton. Why don't you look as well? You are looking well. Watcha me old brown son. If the music hall almost never produces radical songs for the reasons mentioned above, it can produce occasional social satire or dissent. And here we have a dissenting song from 1907, when to seek help when you were unemployed was often felt as being to admit moral failure. Being unemployed was often seen as a lack of character. And the workhouse, a place of deliberate hardship designed to shame the unemployed into finding work at any cost, remained as the ultimate deterrent. And so this song was quite radical at the time. What's the use of kicking up a row if there ain't no work about? If you can't get a job, you can rest in bed till the school kids all comes out. If you can't get work, you can't get the sack. That's an argument the sensible is sound. Lay your head back on your pillow and read your Daily Mirror and wait till the work comes round.
You can't see the audience, but we all want to sing along with you.
Thank you. I'm also illustrating something which people forget about the musical. The singers were not great singers. They were entertainers. Technically, they were not great singers. Although they were more in tune than me. This song is a wonderful mocking anthem about a working class man who's transformed his backyard into something resembling the countryside, but not really. And he ends by saying, "It's such a wonderful find." From the top of the house, you could see all the way to Wembley if it wasn't for the houses in between. Other songs could push back at excessive respectability, escaping momentarily from the strict moralism which reigned in the public sphere. This one by Maury Lloyd. As I take my morning promenade, I'm quite a fashion card on the promenade. Now I don't mind nice boys staring hard if it satisfies their desire. Do you think that my dress is a little bit, just a little bit, not too much of it? If it shows my shape just a little bit, that's the little bit the boys admire. There were also, naturally enough, conservative songs. I just wanted to mention, because I have a minute, I just want to mention the great popularity of male impersonators. These are women dressed as men, who, the most famous of being Vesta Tilly, and who often would mock the toffs, or they would mock different categories of men. Now, it should be pointed out, this is gentle mockery. Everybody liked it, men and women alike. And I think it's sometimes been overinterpreted as if the women in the musical audience were all feminists before the time. But very, very interesting development that the woman dressed as a man was allowed to say things which wouldn't have been respectable for a man to say. Just one more thing about the Morning Promenade as well. These slightly suggestive songs could be, I'm not going to illustrate this, but they could have gestures added to them, and the gestures could be, let's say, more or less explicit, depending on the part of town you were playing in. Now, there are conservative elements in musical, but I think they have been exaggerated. Certainly, the desire of musical managers to integrate local elites meant that they were obsessed with respectability, and supporting the British Empire was part of being respectable. So, in big waves of strikes, such as 1911 to 13, although musical artists might easily give shows for free to raise money for hungry strikers, they did not sing on stage songs in support of the strike. Nevertheless, we have the conservative songs. Here's a few, all from 1900, which is the time of the big crisis in the Boer War. Now, I wanted to repeat what I said before, that there are 20, 30 songs about the Boer, many of them patriotic. They will be replaced by other comic songs a few weeks later, and I think it has been overinterpreted. In addition, although obviously we have huge patriotic songs, Mafeking's Hero, The Defender of Mafeking, Victory, Victory, we also have songs mocking. Baby's Name is Kitchener is a song about somebody who's decided to name their new baby with 17 names, all names of British generals. And The Girl in the Khaki Dress is a Maury Lloyd song mocking the obsession with khaki, so the uniform colour of the British Army, and ending with the rather rude comment, "My sister's just had khaki twins," suggesting, obviously, illegitimate sex. So, moving on to my conclusion, the musical was big money for the theatre chains and sheet music publishers. The relative lack of creative autonomy made radical politics vanishingly rare on the musical stage, while the sing-along format made consensual topics massively dominant. Political songs could be found outside the music hall in a country which, as I reminded you, had 3 million pianos. The Irish nationalist newspapers carried songs in every issue put to well-known tunes. Trade unionists sang The Red Flag or Jerusalem or When Wilt Thou Save the People. If you go to the suffrage meetings, you will be able to sing along. Well, I don't have the tunes, so I'm not going to sing it to you. Shout, shout, up with your song, cry with the wind, for the dawn is breaking. This is the March of the Women, extremely popular and known around the country by Ethel Smith. And of course, these were very important, and certainly the role of song in empowerment was very, very important there. And notice the religious reference at the end. Thunder of Freedom, the voice of the Lord. Very well-known song at the time in 1900, the Red Flag. A few other words here, yes. It suits today the weak and base whose minds are fixed on pelf and place to cringe before the rich man's frown and whore the sacred emblem down. And another song which was very popular in the trade union movement is this one. When will thou save the people, O God of mercy, when? Not kings and lords, but nations. Not thrones and crowns, but men. Flowers of thy hearts, O gods, are they. Sorry, flowers of thy hearts, O God, are they. Let them not pass like these away, the heritage, a sunless day. God save the people. But note what kind of radical songs these are. They are anthems. They are marching songs. They are not the reflective work of people considering they have an artistic vision. It is not the times they are a-changing of Bob Dylan. It is not shipbuilding. by Elvis Costello. It is not White Privilege 2 by Macklemore. It's the marching song, it's the anthem. And I think there is a long building of tradition in popular song necessary before you have the artistic radical song that we enjoy today. 23 minutes and 41 seconds, not too bad. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you. So thank you for a great paper on the almost absence of political songs in musicals, and thank you for singing along with the slides that you showed us. It was great to hear as well, to hear your voice. Does anyone have any questions in the audience? I can start if you'd like. So perhaps I could start, and then in the audience, you can be online as well. If anyone has questions online, of course, don't hesitate to say. Perhaps my first question, if nobody wants to start, would be on the reception of these musicals. Have they been exported outside Britain, or do you know anything about that?
Yes, certainly. They were mostly exported to British colonies. Remember, there were a lot of them. And so the singer, I ought to mention actually, one third of the singers were women. And probably slightly more than a third, in 1900, slightly more than a third of the big stars. So they normally travelled around Britain, a town every week. But they could also sign up for 3 months in South America, basically going to the English-speaking communities around South America, 6 months in North America, 3 months in Australia, 3 months in Africa. They really did go around the world. The main source for this is the Performer. The Performer is the weekly newspaper of the trade union of variety artists. Not for 1900. It begins in 1908, and it's just absolute wonderful source that I think nobody has opened for the last 20 years except myself.
And was it also the working class attending the musicals abroad, or was that a different kind of audience? I was wondering about the.
Now that's something I know much less about. I think that because I don't know much about the sociology of the British people who ended up, say, in Melbourne, Australia. I would imagine there is quite a lot of working class people going. It may well be different in India, where you have the colonial civil service and their wives, than in Australia, where you get people who are desperately poor and therefore moving to Australia to make a living. But I must admit, you got me there. I would have to talk to Virginie Huaron or somebody like that.
Okay, thank you, John. Thanks. Antonella, has got a question? Can you hear Antonella, or I can repeat the question when she's asked?
I'm just wondering, in terms of how the songs circulated, were they circulated in what we call broadsheets, or you mentioned, songs being printed on newspapers, or were they just periodicals just for that?
Well, I got it. The main circulation is sheet music. A hit song something like My Morning Promenade would sell 500,000 sheet music copies. Now, a lot of these would be bought by people who knew somebody who could read them and play them on the piano, or they might just buy them just for the words. Otherwise, they would be... So the working class and the lower middle class would be going to the musical, but the songs would be heard elsewhere as well. Street singers would sing them, and in the bourgeois musical evenings, they would have, some chamber music, and then for a laugh, they'd have a couple of musical songs, and feel a little ashamed. So, in fact, they were really mass media, and the sheet music was the centre, and the sheet music publishers made a lot of money. They had a lot of problems because there's no copyright law, and so they would have people on the market illegally selling their sheet music, and so they would send gangs of men around to beat them up to dissuade them. This is around 1900, so it was just like today, really.
Okay, Dan Erickson?
Thank you for this. I really love the singing. Thank you. I was wondering about the sort of radical reaction or the radical reception of music hall as a sort of entertainment institution, as well as as well as the songs. So were the songs picked up by radicals who would sing them in radical meetings alongside the labor anthems? Or the Marseillaise, if they were sort of, if they had French inclinations, as you have in sort of anarchist circles up to 1900, or would they have a very critical sort of view of this, seeing, oh, this is just entertainment for the masses that pacifies it rather than helps it rise in revolt?
Yes, there was something of a debate on this, and the sources get better, in my opinion, the sources get better after 1906, 1907, when you get the Daily Herald, which is a very left-wing newspaper, has been little studied, and which is an anti-war newspaper, which is published throughout the entire First World War with almost no censorship. So it's very, very interesting. And there's debates in there against the people saying, music hall, it's a terrible thing which is distracting the masses. Other voices saying, well, no, that having entertainment which talks about our lives is a step forward. So you get to get this debate between basically left-wing people who sympathise with the establishment desire to civilise the working classes, and the way forward is the cheap classical concerts in the town halls, which were very popular, and so I think there is a huge voice saying, very, very distrustful of music hall, but then there's also voices defending it. Now, music hall is changing in the sense that in the 1830s and 1840s there were a lot of bawdy songs, des chansons paillardes, which I would not be repeating here. I mean, really proper stuff, and that was finished by the time you got the big theatres. So all you could get was suggestive songs, things like Maury Lloyd's. A song about a lady going on the train. She'd never had her ticket punched before. That was about the limit of what you could get. But of course, the gestures could be added, singers were occasionally taken to court for this. But I'd say that the left wing were divided on the question, and probably didn't make it a huge central question either. Certainly, respectability was very important to the left. Respectability still needs a lot of studying, because on the one hand it tended to mean respecting the social hierarchies, and on the other hand it tended to mean respecting working class lives. So a respectable working class man, what did he do? He wasn't dead drunk every night. He didn't beat his wife, as well as probably. Respectability was had different meanings for different people, but certainly had some useful aspects for working class movements. It wasn't purely an outside thing imposed. That's the two-word. That's the two-minute version.
Thank you, John. You've got two following questions: one from Stefan Hurst and then one from Richard.
Thank you very much, John. Just to ask you if you'd I wanted to ask if you were aware of variations among the music halls. I mean, were some known to be, say, for instance, more conservative, or others more radical? Were there specificities depending on the actual location?
Yes, definitely. They tended to often receive the same artists. So there was a limit to the big differences, yeah. But nevertheless, singers knew that they could be much ruder in such and such a part of town, not generally the working class part of town. The working class part of town didn't like the bawdy so much. But there was also big differences. I mean, in Glasgow, the first house was at 10 o'clock in the morning for the men coming off the shipbuilding night shift. Also in Glasgow, if they didn't like the singer, they threw rivets, which they used for making ships. They didn't throw tomatoes; they threw rivets. This is Glasgow for you. So yes, there was a difference, but it tended to be I don't think there were radical musicals, because you couldn't fill a music hall every night with radical. So very, very different from France, where the café concert, one, is much smaller, and secondly, has a resident singer. They don't arrive in a new town every night. They want to make an audience loyal, which is not. It's a completely different ball game in Britain and France. Also, in France, the songwriters receive royalties for every time the song is sung, so they can spend a lot more time writing the songs. Whereas when the musical songs are great, like some of the ones I sang, they are great because it's really good kind of ironic theatre. They're not great musically, because it's, you know, de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum. They're not full of poetic metaphor and so on, but they're really well-observed social theatre, and some of them are real crackers, yeah.
Thanks, John. Richard, and perhaps it'll be the last question, because then we'll have the break. Thank you.
Okay. I was wondering about audition, and whether, I suppose the sort of the stars of music hall were probably the saints, but whether there was a particular role for authorship as well, and whether some individuals might have become wealthy or well-known through creating this material. And if so, what sort of status they had in the public eye, whether they counted or whether they were kind of in the shadows more, and to what extent they themselves might be part of this kind of popular voice, or would they have a sort of a professional status that which would make them kind of specialists looking at this as a sort of a challenge rather than as something that's coming to them sort of spontaneously, you see what I mean? I mean, basically, are these songs coming up out of the people, or are there a sort of a professional songwriting class that emerges that become specialised in producing this kind of material?
Yes, I don't think songs come out of the people. In general, they have more or less influence of popular priorities and popular empowerment. The songwriters, well, they were changing, but I would say in 1900 the average songwriter was an alcoholic who couldn't pay their rent. Managed to sell two songs a month to the singers in the pub next to the theatre, and that's how they managed to pay their rent and make a living. And some of them were really good at it. Just as today, nobody had the magic touch. If you write a rap piece today and it's an absolute bestseller, sells millions, that doesn't mean your next one will be. There's a certain magic in popular music where you have to be a little bit ahead of the curve, but not too much. And that was also the case then. So, as I say, a lot of lumpen proletariat songwriters, contrary to in France, where there were quite educated people and it shows, a lot of lumpen proletariat, but you're getting more and more now at this time, little by little, professionals, people receiving a salary from the publishing companies. Now, they were very much professionals in the sense that they were giving the market what they wanted. So the endless numbers of Irish songs are not written by Irish people. The people who were writing pro-war songs, they would have written anti-war songs if they sold. It wasn't a problem. And people wrote pro-suffrage songs and anti-suffrage songs. There's no business like show business. You do what comes up. Some of them sold. Some of them had hundreds of hits. Nevertheless, they often died in poverty and very frequently of alcohol. I think you need to remember something about alcohol at the time, because the temperance movement, there were two temperance movements, there was a middle class one and a working class one. And today we think of people who are against alcohol as a bit boring. At the time, it was not unusual to find people dead of alcohol in the working class streets. So the working class anti-alcohol movement, it had its reasons, some of the great ones, like, what was it, Fred Godfrey, There are websites on Fred Godfrey's songs, and they just churn them out and say, oh wait, this year people want Irish songs, let's do some Irish songs, you know, I wish I could go back to Ireland. And then the singer would get up and say, you know, this is something that always makes me think of my Irish grandmother. They didn't have an Irish grandmother, they were just making it all up, you know. It's the wonderful thing about two wonderful things about popular music. One is authenticity. If you can fake that, you've got it made. And the other is a wonderful expression, I can't remember who said it, it's the victory of performance over content. Because if you look at great pop songs like the Beatles, She Loves You, Yeah, 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 there's nothing there, there's nothing in the content, and yet it's a great song, and there's some magic which is very specific. Also popular song, completely different in my view from other creative forms, because who reads a favourite novel 100 times? But listening to a favourite pop song 100 times is not a lot. I will stop.
Okay, perhaps we'll stop on that, John. Thank you very much again for your presentation,
you.
For your singing, for waking us up with these lively songs. So thank you very much. And I think we can thank you. And thank Antonella as well for the great panel that you formed together. Thank you. And I'm afraid you won't be able to join us for coffee, but now it's time to have a